I tell my dad, I said, Papi, I think I know what I want to be when I grow up. He says, what's that, son? I want to be an astronaut. And he looked at me with a challenging tone and he said, you want to be what?
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. In this season, we're talking about movement. And today, we will journey to the stars thanks to our guest's sensational life story, a migrant farm worker kid turned astronaut, whose grandfather used to tell him that we cannot go through life without aspirations and goals.
Our guest today is former NASA astronaut José Moreno Hernández. He first joined NASA in 2001 at Houston's Johnson Space Center, becoming chief of the Materials and Processes branch a year later. As part of the Structural Engineering Division, he was responsible for the implementation of the U.S.-Russian Highly Enriched Uranium Agreement, resulting from Russia's nuclear weapon dismantling. He later served as program manager at the U.S. Department of Energy. In 2004, he was selected as an astronaut candidate by NASA, completing his training 2 years later. In 2009, Hernández journeyed on the STS-128 mission aboard Space Shuttle Discovery to the International Space Station. Previously at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, José Hernández developed the first full-field digital mammography imaging system used to spot breast cancer in its early stages. José Hernández holds a master's degree in electrical and computer engineering from the University of California in Santa Barbara and a BS in electrical engineering from the University of the Pacific. Honored by numerous awards, including 2 NASA Service Awards, the National Hispanic Hero Award, and 7 honorary doctorate degrees. He's the founder of a space consulting company and the author of the book Reaching for the Stars, the inspiring story of a migrant farm worker turned astronaut. Now a vineyard owner through the José M. Hernández Reaching for the Stars Foundation, he's devoted to support and promote education among students and the community, inspiring youth to find passion in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Such an honor to have you here today, sir. Good morning.
Good morning, Cecilia. A pleasure being here. Thank you for having me.
Mr. Hernández, your story is fascinating. You became a NASA astronaut, an engineer, a pilot, an author, vineyard owner, a motivational speaker, an entrepreneur, and I could go on and on. But I'd rather let you take us to California's San Joaquin Valley, where everything started. And we want to hear those childhood years where you, with your parents and siblings, were traveling year after year, working and harvesting the fields of Central California through a season route that would always end at La Piedad in Michoacán, Mexico, to restart that nomad cycle again. How was your childhood like, sir?
Well, Cecilia, let me take you a little bit back even before that so you can appreciate how this amazing and wonderful journey I have traveled thus far has occurred. I'm a first generation Mexican American born in the United States. But my parents, and my story starts well before I am even born. My father out of economic necessity, needed to come to work in the United States because he was part of a large family in Mexico, and he was one of the oldest boys. So he did what many people from his state, Michoacán, do, and that is they come north to the United States, and they work in the only area they know how to work, which is agriculture. So they come to California, and then they establish this nomadic lifestyle where they follow the harvest of the crops. California is a long state, so the harvest of the crops starts in the south, where it's warmest, and then it moves to central California, and then finally to northern California. So what my father would do, along with other Michoacanos, would be arrive in Southern California, work 2 months strawberry harvest, and then near Los Angeles, and then he would move up to central California in Salinas, and there he would pick more strawberries and then lettuce, harvest the lettuce for salads. And after that, 2 months there, so that's 4 months already, then he would go north to Stockton, California, and there he would spend 5 months because that's the longest of the season, where he would start harvesting cucumbers, cherries, peaches, pears, green tomatoes for market, and end the year with the grape harvest. That would take you, the whole journey would start on March, and it would end about November. In November, come November, he would go back home to his home state for 3 months. And mind you, he started this when he was 15 years old, and he only had a third grade education. When he was 18, he met my mother, my future mother.
Beautiful, and, by the way, I saw her in the book. She is like Dolores del Río. She's beautiful.
Yes, exactly. She's like an actress. So you see those old-time pictures, and she's beautiful. And I'm so happy to say that I still have my parents today healthy here in Stockton. But they met in their hometown, and my dad incorporated her into this nomadic lifestyle. And this nomadic lifestyle was, well, she went with him on these nine-month journeys and come home for 3 months. And of course, with any marriage come kids. And so now you say, now you realize why I was born in the U.S. There's four of us. I'm the youngest of four. And you have a 9 in 12 chances of being born in the United States, a 3 in 12 chances of being born in Mexico. Well, there's four of us. Two of us were born in the United States, and two were born in Mexico. And so it was just the luck of the draw. What the month you were born in dictated what country you were going to be born in. And so now imagine our lifestyle when we when I start school in the kindergarten. You know, my first exposure to school, you got to remember that even though I was born in the United States, we were a Latino Mexican family with Mexican culture, and so we spoke Spanish in at home, and not even proper Spanish. It was third grade Spanish, basically. But that's the language. That was my native language, even though I was born in the United States. And so, kindergarten, we come to Southern California, and I get thrown into a kindergarten class. There was no English as a second language courses back then. It was you just thrown in with the population and you sink or swim. And just as I get to know my teacher, my friends, where the bathroom's at, 2 months come and go. And now we go to Salinas to my second kindergarten class, my second teacher, my second set of friends. I learn where that bathroom's at, 2 months come and go, and we move up to Stockton, California. So now I'm up to my third kindergarten teacher, my third set of friends, and then we go to Mexico for 3 months. So my dad asked us to get 3 months worth of homework from our teachers. And in Mexico, my mom would wake us up every day, Monday through Friday, from 8 a.m. to 12 noon. And she would put us in my grandma's kitchen, give us a cup of hot cocoa and some bread. And we would do our homework from 8 a.m. to 12, self-study for those 3 months we were in Mexico. And then next year, when I'm in the first grade, that whole process repeated itself. So as you can see, it wasn't a very
conducive environment to get a good education. It wasn't great, but...
I can imagine how difficult it was to keep up with learning and changing classrooms and friends and teachers. But then I would like to ask you, when were you able to speak English fluently in those conditions?
Well, that happened when I was in the second grade, Cecilia. When I was in the second grade... we were in our last stop in Northern California, Stockton, California. And my dad gets up in the morning, one November morning, as he usually does every year, and he makes what we call the big announcement. And what's the big announcement? Kids, we're going to Mexico next week. Get 3 months worth of homework. All right? That was the big announcement. So I go and to my school, of course, I'm used to it because I did it for kindergarten. I did it for first grade. Now I'm doing it for second grade. And my siblings even more because they're older than me. But I go to my second grade teacher, Miss Young, and I give her the news that we're going to Mexico and that my father asked me to ask her to give me 3 months worth of homework. And Miss Young was a beautiful young Asian teacher, fresh out of college. And she sort of looked at me with a frustrated look. I could understand her frustration because she had done this for my three other older siblings. This is the fourth time she was doing it for the Hernandez family, putting 3 months worth of homework together. But I guess the fourth time was the charm because she's basically told me when I told her I wanted 3 months worth of homework, she said, "You tell your parents that after school, I'm going to come to their house and speak, to your house and speak to them." Well, I got scared because the teacher never comes to our house. And I remember I didn't even wait for my siblings after the school bell rang at the end of the day. I went and ran straight home because, I had some juicy news to give to my parents. And I remember when I got home, my parents always get home because they worked in agriculture in the fields, but they get home before we get out of school. They prided themselves in always being home. And my dad at that time is a very strict, special kind of guy. You know, he was short on words, quick on action, you know what I mean. A disciplinarian, if you will. My mom, on the other hand, was the comforting one, the sweet one, kind of a yin and yang kind of thing. I think that's why I grew up so balanced, because I had both extremes. But I remember I walked into the house. My dad had just gotten home from work, and he was taking his boots off there in the living room. And I said, "Okay, I guess I got to tell my dad first." So I give my dad the news that Miss Young was coming over. And I was telling him, I think it has to do with, and he didn't let me finish the sentence because he got up and he starts taking off his belt. My dad has a different judicial system than the traditional judicial system. He believes in jumping to conclusions, doling out the punishment, and then asking what happened, you know? And I don't know how I escaped that time from being whipped, but I told him that it had to do with Mexico and she wanted to talk about that. And so he kind of believed me. So he didn't whip me. But now I have to go tell my mom. And my mom, every Latina, a Mexican woman, even though she works all day in the fields, where is she? She's in the kitchen cooking up a storm for the kids that come home. Her strategy was always she would fix us a little snack, beans, rice, salsa, tortillas, and she would feed us in the kitchen table. All the kids would gather around, sit down and eat, but then she would not let us get up until we finish our homework. So she was the one that made sure we were on point in our studies. And so I remember I tell my mom, after I tell my dad, I have to tell my mom. I go to the kitchen, tell my mom, and she, completely different reaction from my dad, like a typical Mexican woman. She puts, I don't know if you guys remember the movie Home Alone with Macaulay Culkin. She puts the Home Alone face. She says, "The teacher's coming. We have to sweep, we have to mop, I have to cook a dinner because we got to treat her right." And so we have a great meal that day because Miss Young came. But then Miss Young, basically convinces my parents that we needed to stay in one place and not move around so much. My dad would argue back with her in a sense that she says, you guys move around too much and it's hurting the education of your kids. And my dad's response to that was, Miss Young, we move on a Saturday. In other words, we finish our one school on Friday. Monday, we were in the new school. We did not miss a day of school, was my dad's point. So my dad says, what's the problem? And then Miss Young says, yes, but then you go to Mexico for 3 months. Well, yeah, Miss Young, but they take your homework and they self-study. So in my dad's eyes, he was meeting his obligation of providing us an education. He didn't realize that moving us around was detrimental to our education. And it wasn't until Miss Young used the tree as an analogy. She said, Mr. Hernandez, you're an expert in agriculture. Let me give you this example, this problem that you can solve. Maybe it'll help both of us. She says, what happens if I give you a tree in a potted plant and I ask you to plant it in a very good ground? You take good care of it, fertilize it, water it, and then in 3 months, replant it somewhere else. And then in another 3 months, you replant it. Every 3 months, you're replanting that fruit tree. What happens to that tree in the long run? And my dad answered the question quite honestly. She said, well, Miss Young, the tree is not going to die because you're feeding it. She says, but it's going to stunt its growth. The tree is going to be small, weak, fragile. And if it's a fruit tree, it probably won't even bear fruit because it's going to be so weak. Why? Because you're not letting the roots grow deep. The tree has to be in one place for the roots to grow deep and the branches to grow big and strong. He even raises his hands, says, big and strong. And then you can count to 2 seconds, Cecilia. In 2 seconds, his face expression, facial expression changes.
He understood.
He realized that example represented what he was doing to his kids. And to my dad's credit, because he was a very proud man, but to his credit, he looked at Miss Young and said, is that what you mean? And Miss Young said, that's what I mean. I think my job is done here. And from that moment on, Cecilia, we still went to Mexico every year, but the 3-month trips were cut to 3 weeks centered around Christmas vacation. And we stopped moving around. We would come directly to Northern California, only one place. So now Stockton, California was our home. We became stable. We only had one teacher and we started learning the English language. And this is why I always tell everybody that even though I was born in this great country of the United States, I did not consider myself fluent until I was 12 years old because of our living situation. But, you know, finally I caught up and I started doing very well.
But as you said, we have to give credit to your parents because to be at sync with what she asked them to do, to change a whole view of life, first, is not easy. Second, I mean, economically speaking, they had to do some changes, you know, because that's the way they were used to earn money and to raise your siblings. I think that is a major, major change in mentality, in it putting resources in everything. That is amazing from your parents and, of course, from your teacher.
Yeah, that's correct, Cecilia, because, you know, we moved around for a reason. That was to find work. So when my father made the decision to stay in one place, in essence, our economic situation turned from bad to worse.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in one place signified that sometimes there was no work or work was very slim pickings of the amount of work. I remember You know, we were a very humble family. I thank God for my parents, for my father, that he was a hard worker, very proud man. I never went to bed hungry. But I'll tell you, I had my fair share of just rice, beans, salsa, and tortillas. I remember when my dad would make an announcement that we were going to have guests, I would get so happy because when guests come, you know, they take out all the bells and whistles and magically the protein appears in form of a piece of meat, chicken, or something like that. So I loved when we had visitors because then we would have meat. Other than that, if we didn't have visitors, it was rice and beans kind of thing.
But I think that and the hard work ethic that you learned from your family and what you're talking about, your mom and your dad, now it really matches up with what you always say in your motivational talks, what I've heard. You say to kids, always give more than it is expected from you. And I think that drives you further in terms of how you're perceived by others, not only, but also, and more important, this impact within yourself, how you become a better person, a better human being when pursuing excellency, which, by the way, is very far away from the idea of trying to achieve perfection. Instead, as you say, it is about giving your best and linking yourself to others through service. As we saw, your mom was making everything ready to be able to welcome Miss Young, right?
Exactly. And you know, that point, piece of advice I got from my father when I first told him I wanted to be an astronaut. That was one of his points when he sat me down. Absolutely. So a lot I owe to the guidance, the wisdom of a man who only has a third grade education, yet he was wise enough to guide me to believe in thinking I can reach the dream of me wanting to be an astronaut.
Mr. Hernandez, what would you say to youth today or to people that are very skeptical about hard work?
That's very interesting, Cecilia. You know, a lot of people look at me and say, wow, you were very lucky to get selected as an astronaut. You know, more than 18,000 people apply and only 12 to 15 get accepted. And they say, wow, you got lucky. You were very lucky. And, you know, my response to them is, you know, I find myself that the harder I work, the luckier I get. So there's no substitute for hard work. There's no shortcuts. You have to keep working hard. And thank God my parents instilled in me a work ethic that allows me to go after any dream I have. And I sincerely believe, and I tell the kids, I said, look, anything is possible in life if you're willing to work hard for it. You know, you've got to make sacrifices and you got to make commitments towards that goal. You can't haphazardly say, oh, this is what I want to do, but, you know, I really want to do other stuff, but I really want to do this grand thing. Well, you know, if you're not all the way in, you're not going to get there. You got to be all the way in. And that's what I found myself doing is ever since I was 10 years old, I said, I want to be an astronaut. And I always work towards that. Every decision I made, going to college, what major, what job I got, I looked at it from the eyes of, is this going to help my goal of becoming an astronaut?
And Mr. Hernandez, the summer of 69, so you were growing up surrounded by love, as we heard, of your family and the many hardships, including the heavy work that comes along with being a migrant family. But then in July 20th, it was a special day, right?
Yes.
Could you take us there?
Yeah, actually, it was December. It was 1972. It was the last mission when this part occurred. I was already familiar with the Apollo program, but I remember for the very first time, I saw an Apollo mission live on TV. And it's December 1972, the very last mission, Apollo 17. It was an afternoon in December. Almost nighttime. and cold December up here in Northern California, and they canceled programming on TV. We had one of those, you know, vacuum tube TVs, console TVs, black and white. We couldn't afford cable TV, so we had the rabbit ear antenna on top with grandma's knitting on the bottom. And so that was our TV. And quite often, my dad would have me hold the antenna to improve reception. And he would say, stay there if it's something important. Because, you know, when you hold the TV antenna, reception improves. But in that particular instance, I remember programming got preempted. And there's showing the very last astronaut who's walked on the moon. We haven't sent a human since 1972. And this is none other than astronaut Gene Cernan walking on the moon. And there I am kneeling in front of the TV watching him, hearing him talk to Mission Control Houston. And then I would get up, go outside, and see the moon. It was out. It wasn't full, but it was almost full. I would come back inside and then listen to the reporter. Still remember his name, Walter Cronkite, narrating that moonwalk. And I was just mesmerized. I said, this is what I want to be. I want to be him. I want to be an astronaut. And so the best thing I could have done, Cecilia, that same evening as a 10-year-old,
yeah,
I tell my dad, I said, Papi, I think I know what I want to be when I grow up. He says, what's that, son? And we were walking towards our bedroom. It was nighttime. He was walking in front of me. And I said, I want to be an astronaut. He stutter steps, almost stumbles, and stops dead in his tracks. And I stop because I'm right behind him. And he turns around and looks at me, you know, the shadow of his face. It's dark kind of thing. He looks at me and he's very intimidating when he gets serious to begin with because he's a serious guy. Remember, he's the disciplinarian. And he looked at me with a challenging tone and he said, you want to be what? Normally, I would be scared and I would have said, oh, nothing, Dad. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say anything. But I was so excited that I didn't care. I didn't have time to be afraid. I even said it with an attitude. I said, I want to be an astronaut. He looked at me and he pointed to the kitchen table. He said, let's go to the kitchen. That's when I got scared. In the kitchen, only three things happen. And two already happened. I already told you about the first one. My mom sits us down every day after school. We eat and then she makes us do our homework. She sees that we do it. Done. Second, at my mom's insistence, we all eat dinner at the same time. That was done. Third, let's just say that's where they provided justice. And so now you can see why I was concerned because two of the three things were done and the only one was applying justice. So I thought I was in trouble.
Yeah.
So I go and sit down where I do my homework and my dad sits down next to me and he wasn't mad. He pours himself a glass of milk and pours me a glass of milk. He sits down, crosses his arm like this and he says, now, what's this that you want to be an astronaut? And I just regurgitate, just repeat everything that the reporter, Walter Cronkite, said that evening. I told him, Dad, did you know that this is the last Apollo mission? Did you know that the moon's a 250,000 miles away and that we can send humans to the surface and bring them back home safe and sound? Did you know they're going to build a new space vehicle to go back to space? Say, I want to be part of that. And he must have saw the determination of a 10-year-old boy that he did two things that to me were very important. First, he empowered me in believing in my dream. It's amazing what a parent can do when you're 10 years old, that if they say you can fly, you believe it.
Yeah, and it could go both ways, right?
Yes, exactly. If you squash a dream, that's the same way. Exactly. So I love telling this part for parents, young parents who have kids. I said, feed the dream. Feed the dream. Because my father immediately said, I think you can do it.
And that was enough, right?
When he said that, this timid boy who was hunched over, all of a sudden, you can see me lift up my spirit, my body, and saying, wow, my dad thinks I could be an astronaut. But he didn't stop there, Cecilia. The second thing he did is he says, if you really want to do this, you need to follow a 5-ingredient recipe I'm going to give you. That if you follow it to the letter, I promise you as your father, you'll reach your dream. And I immediately became a sponge ready to absorb what he was going to say. I said, let me know what it is, Dad. What are the steps? He said, first, son, very easy. He said, first, determine your purpose in life. What is Jose going to accomplish in life? And I blurted out, I said, I want to be an astronaut. I figure I got 1 out of 5 done. I'm almost there. All right. Second, he said, recognize how far you are from your goal. I looked down on our kitchen floor, half peeling linoleum. We lived in a 2-bedroom dilapidated rental in the worst part of Stockton, California. And I told my dad, don't get mad, Dad, but I can't be any further than this. And I thought he was going to hit me. But he didn't. He chuckled. He said, well, I'm glad you recognize that, son, because the third thing you got to do is you got to draw yourself a roadmap, a map from where you know where you're at and given by your smart remarks you do to where you want to go, because you have to know the way to your destination. Draw yourself a map. I said, what's the fourth one, Dad? He said, it's education. You got to prepare yourself according to the challenge you selected, and you selected a big challenge, son. So you know you got to go to college and then some. I said, yeah, Dad. And then he said, fifth and final, he pointed outside the kitchen window and said, do you know the effort we put out picking fruits and vegetables Saturdays and Sundays and 7 days a week during the summer with your siblings, your mom, your dad, your father? You know that effort you put out, that work ethic? I said, yeah, Dad. He pointed to my books on the kitchen table. It says, you put that effort there in your books. And you also, when you graduate college, you put it in your job. And that's his parting words that evening, Cecilia, is what you just got through saying. He said, always give more than what people expect out of you. Always give more. That's your normal mode of operation. Always give more. And that stuck with me throughout my life. And I've applied that recipe. And let me tell you, Cecilia, it works. The only other ingredient I would add is the sixth ingredient, which is my own. It's perseverance. It's never giving up. Never giving up on yourselves. Because human tendency is to give up after the first, second, or third failure.
Exactly.
And I'm here to tell you, don't give up. Learn from failures. Prepare yourself more, and you come back stronger, because NASA rejected me not once, not twice, not 3 or 4 times. It's 11 rejections.
We've been talking about discipline, hard work, ethics, love of your family, but there's, of course, other hardships. And I want to ask you, what helped you deal with these obstacles? So, and how was the life for a young man in a dangerous neighborhood? And, of course, exposed to addictions, drugs, violence, and crimes. What can a child of a broken home do? Shall he find himself trapped in this situation?
Sure. Well, it's a good question, Cecilia. Well, first of all, let's talk about cultural identity in terms of how I grew up. You know, you grow up as you're born in the United States. You're an American. But you're a Mexican-American, and your parents teach you the cultural upbringings of their homeland from Mexico. You visit Mexico. You speak Spanish. And so as you grow up as an adolescent, your teenage years, all of a sudden you find yourself in an identity crisis, because when I would go to Mexico for those 3 weeks out of the year and visit with my cousins that live in Mexico and don't come to California, and I had friends over there, they would make fun of me because I spoke Spanish kind of funny. So in their eyes, I was too American to be Mexican. Then I would come to the U.S. and I would hang around with my friends in the U.S. in California, and they would make fun of me because I would speak English with an accent. And in essence, I was too Mexican to be American. So I kind of felt like, what the heck am I then? You know, I'm neither Mexican or American, because in either place, I found myself being somewhat discriminated against. And it wasn't until I was a junior, the year before graduating high school, that I realized what, you know, what I was, and I accepted it. I embraced my bicultural upbringing. And that was when I was, our junior class was going to enter a parade, and they needed a truck and a flatbed to build the float for the parade. And I know my father had a truck. I know he had the trailer, everything, the flatbed. But I didn't want to volunteer because I knew my father. My father would not lend this and put it somewhere else. It was parked in front of our house. And his response, he would lend it. But I knew him. He would say, they have to come here and decorate it here. I'll drive it for them, and then we'll come back here. So he never wanted to let his truck out of his sight. I knew that. So when they asked for volunteers of who had access to a truck and a flatbed, no one raised their hand. I didn't raise my hand because I knew that if I raised my hand, they would have to come to my house, my classmates. And I was embarrassed because we lived in a two-bedroom dilapidated rental in the worst part of Stockton. I didn't want them to know how humble I lived. And so we had other meetings. We were at our last meeting when they were going to cancel our entry into the float, where I finally said, well, I guess I got to tell them that I do have access to a truck. And I finally said, you know, yes, you guys can use my father's, but there's a catch. And they said, what's that? You guys have to build it in my front yard where the truck is at. And they said, oh, no problem, we'll go. And so they all came. And it takes about 3 days to build a float. So I remember when they came on a Wednesday, a bunch of kids came and we were building the float outside. My dad comes out with music. My mom comes with agua fresca, food, feeds the kids. My siblings also participate. So it's a very festive atmosphere. Word gets out in school that there's good food and good atmosphere. So the next day it doubles. And then the next day it triples because, you know, it was actually a very, very great atmosphere. And I remember one of my friends and on that third day came to me. This is a guy who had a brand new car, lived in the nice part of town. And he looked at me and he says, God, I'm so envious of you. I said, envious of me? Why envious of me? I said, look around, look where I live. I said, what's there envious to be? He said, yeah, you know, I have a new car. My mom bought me a new car, but my mom and dad are divorced. My mom works as a nurse. She works all the time. I come home to an empty house. And you come home to this. This is what I want, family. I could see there's a lot of love here. This is what I want to do, what I would love to have in my family. And that's when I realized, Cecilia, that I can take the best parts of my bicultural upbringing and have it define me as an individual. And that's what I tell kids nowadays. I said, yes, you're going to have identity crisis, but you know what? Work it as an advantage. Work it as an advantage and get the best parts of everything so that it defines you as an individual. And you'll see that if you take that approach, it's a much more healthier approach and you're more stronger for it. You're more valuable to a company. You're more valuable as a friend. You're more valuable as a schoolmate. And so that's how I embraced and that's how I dealt with cultural identity. And that's what I would tell the kids today. I said, embrace the differences in culture and take the best parts.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And now let's continue with CC.
What would you say to your friend today, coming from a broken home? Because, you know, feeling cared and loved is the key, is the base to build up self-esteem, to be able to pull through. And sadly, some people just don't have access to it.
What I would say is you look for mentors.
Exactly. That's what I was going to ask you, because there's a lot of gratitude around your story always.
Even though I didn't come from a broken family, I came from a family with lots of love. I also utilized mentors. I had great mentors like Miss Young. I had a lot of teachers during middle school, high school, even college that mentored me. When I started working, I signed up through a mentorship program so I could have a mentor and show me guide me through my career as I was getting more and more experience. So definitely, do not take the lone wolf approach and say, hey, I'm going to conquer the world by myself. No, you gotta accept the help, seek out help and mentorship opportunities so that you could be a good mentee. And then because you know what, after a while, you're going to become a mentor and you're going to be able to help other people. So that's what I would tell kids. That, just because you come from a broken home, it's not over. If you really want to do things, learn from people like myself. Learn, put my recipe to work, and it's going to work for you. And then seek mentors to make things happen for you.
Jose, afterwards you went to college, and you had different jobs to support your studies. And then you graduated from the University of California in Santa Barbara. You received a scholarship there. How was life for you at that time?
Oh, yeah, it was great. First of all, undergraduate was tough because I had to work to help pay tuition. So sometimes I would have two jobs as a waiter and work at a store to help offset the costs of tuition. So it was very tough in undergraduate. And then I went to graduate school. I applied for a scholarship, a fellowship, and it was the first time I had a full ride scholarship. I remember, I thought graduate school was going to be so tough, but because I didn't have to take a job, I could dedicate 100% to my studies. And to me, it was the most enjoyable experience, going to school, not having to worry about the financial aspect of school. And I did very well in graduate school. I zoomed right through it, and I loved it. It gave me a chance to apply for jobs, and I applied where I did a couple of internships at Lawrence Livermore Lab, and they hired me as a career employee. And I started working there. I worked over 16 and a half years at Lawrence Livermore Lab.
And there you developed something wonderful. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, before that, I started working at the lab. I worked in on a project called the X-ray laser. It was going to be a space deployed laser for national defense. And when that project got canceled, there were about 300 of us. There's about 14,000 that work at the National Lab, but our project was a 300-person project. So when the project gets canceled, everybody has to look for new jobs within the lab. My boss asked me, hey, stick around because, the work you've been doing is very interesting, and I think we could find an application. I was doing Monte Carlo 3D X-ray transport analysis, modeling how X-rays interact with matter. And he felt, he basically told me, I think you have the answer to a question. We don't know what that question is. Will you stay and let's find what that question is so that we can put your work, apply your work to another application? And I said, sure. I was honored that he asked me to stay. I was the only one that was asked to stick around. And sure enough, he and I became the co-developers of the first full-field digital mammography system for the earlier detection of breast cancer. Back then, radiographs for mammograms were film. Doctors put it on a light and they interpreted the images to try to find early precursors to breast cancer. Well, we developed a digital system that acquires the images digitally at a lower dose to the patient, images much more clear, much more information content. We opened up the whole area of computer-aided diagnosis, and we demonstrated that our images were superior than the old film screen technology. And everybody knows that more information content means to earlier detection. Earlier detection leads to saving lives. So I am convinced that our system has saved thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives. People think that when they ask me what's my proudest professional moment, they expect me to answer, well, hey, I was selected by NASA as an astronaut and I went into space. It's not that. It's the fact that I was the co-developer of the first full-field digital mammography system for early breast cancer detection. And I'm very proud of that.
You should. Incredible. At this point of your life, the dream of becoming an astronaut was coming out from a dormant stage, I guess. And you were at a stage where you fulfilled the requirements asked by NASA. That's my understanding. But you did not get accepted. Actually, you were rejected 11 times. Could you explain our audience what these requirements were and what did you have to go through to finally get selected?
Sure. Well, you know, back then, the requirements were that you had to have a career in the sciences. And I did in engineering. And if you only had a bachelor's, you needed 5 years experience before you applied. If you had a master's, you needed 3 years experience before you applied. And if you had a PhD, you could apply right away. I had a master's, so after I started working 3 years at the lab, I started putting in my application. And so I kept getting rejected. And at first, I thought that was normal. I said, you know, it's expected. I'm young. I don't have the experience. But every time I took a job at the lab, I always try to make sure it helped me get closer in NASA's eyes to becoming an astronaut. And it wasn't until the sixth time that I got rejected that I almost gave up. By this time, I was married. And I told my wife, I said, you know, I should stop this silly dream, and because it's not going to happen. I've already got rejected six times. It's obviously not going to happen. And instead of getting some sympathy from her, she kind of dressed me down and said, she challenged me because she says, "So you're a quitter?" I said, "No, I'm not a quitter." I said, "Yeah, look, six times, that's enough. I should just get on with my career." And she read the last sentence on the letter of my rejection letter, my sixth rejection letter, and it said, "Please feel free to reapply at our next selection." And she says I agree, NASA doesn't want you this year. NASA didn't want you the previous years, but you don't know if NASA's going to want you next year or the next year. So, and if you quit yourself, she said, you're always going to have this little worm of curiosity inside of you that's going to gnaw at you, wondering what if. And you're going to become a bitter old man, and I don't want to be married to a bitter old man. So you ought to think about, you know, reapplying. And then she said something that resonated with me when she left. As she was walking away, she says, "I don't know what they have," meaning the astronauts they selected, "that you don't have." Because in her eyes, I was prepared. And when she said that, I said, "Well, I don't know either what they have that I don't have. I've never done a comparison." I said, "Maybe I should compare myself to them." And I did. And that's when I noticed that they were all pilots. And I wasn't a pilot. So I took flying lessons. I became a pilot. The next election round that I didn't get selected, I made that same comparison. And of course, they were all pilots. And I was a pilot, so I was happy. But then I took a deeper look into their curriculum, and I saw that they were all scuba certified. I wasn't scuba certified. So I became scuba certified basic, advanced, master, scuba rescue. I wanted to make sure NASA knew I knew how to scuba dive. So that's the thing that I did, is I compared myself to them. And then I said, okay, now that I look like them, more like the similar curriculum of what they're selecting, I said, I'm sure there's still thousands of people that have that type of curriculum. I said, what can I do to differentiate myself? And that's when the lab was looking for scientists to go work in Russia and help the Russians take control of their nuclear stockpile. This is when the Soviet Union first broke up, and the newly formed Russian Federation had all excess nuclear stockpile weapons, and they didn't know what to do with them or how to protect them. And so they asked the State Department in the United States if we could help. And of course, I worked at a national lab, and we knew that subject. And so when the State Department asked for volunteers to work in this new project, no one wanted to do it because it involved a lot of travel. It was like a 5-year project. You would travel 6-7 times a year to Siberia, none other place, to the nuclear weapons complex sites of the Russians, and help them do vulnerability analysis, put measures to control and protect their material so it doesn't disappear, and all those type of things. And no one wanted to do it. But man, I raised my hand. I said, "Put me in, coach. I'll go." And it wasn't because I wanted to get to know Siberia in the middle of winter. It was because I said, this is my great differentiator. I had just read in the news that Russia and the United States had signed an agreement to build what was going to be the International Space Station. So I figured we were going to work with the Russians in the future in space. So I said, I'm going to get a jump start, start working with the Russians. And I not only did that, but I told my boss I would take this job if and only if he would put a Russian language instructor to work with me when I'm stateside. And he said, "Yeah, we have an education budget. So ya понимаю по-русски язык." I learned Russian, and I worked with the Russians. And all of a sudden, when I started turning in my application with NASA, they were interested, and so they interviewed. I became, on my 10th try, I was on the list of 100 finalists where I was invited to spend a week at NASA, and they take a good look at you. And from those 100, they'll select 10 to 15 astronauts. And I didn't get selected the 10th time, but I made it the 100. The 11th time, I made it the 100, still didn't get selected. The 12th time I made it to the final 100, and that's when I got selected. So perseverance is key, but it's got to be strategic perseverance, not just passive perseverance. It's got to be strategic, just like I did that. Remember I said I met the minimum requirements, then I compared myself with the people that they were selecting, made sure I looked like them, and then I differentiated myself. I said, what can I do to even make myself even more an outlier so that they would take a look at me. And that's what I did.
And Jose, of course, I'm going to ask you, how did you feel when you were told first that you were accepted by NASA and then that you were finally going to a mission? But because these are two different stages, right? Then before this, I would love to share with our audience something about your book, because I really enjoyed reading it. As you were getting ready for the assigned mission with your fellow crew members, I think this experience of yours was purely mystical. kind of a ritual that awakens you to another dimension of reality and prepares you to a transcendent journey. You wrote in your book, and I'm quoting, "The calm sea brought an inevitable silence that put us at ease before parting for the journey into space. I look out at the rhythmic and lulling waves of the Sea of Cortez as the sun began to set, making ponder. At what point do the sea and the sky become one? We're all astronauts, and each one of us has our own star, the star of dreams. Our life is the path to it." How was this team building experience, Jose, before going to space?
It was a great experience. We did several team building experiences that put us in extreme conditions as a team. We did water survival training. We did winter survival training, cold weather training. We did wilderness survival training where we're in the middle of nowhere, no food, no water. We had to trap our own food and water and get to a pickup point. And then we did the Baja trip. And I think this allowed us to get comfortable with each other, all seven of us, where we can finish each other's sentences, where we learn the strengths and the weaknesses of each other. And we were able to support each other so that the whole team was successful. And so I think that's what helped us. Once I got into this vehicle and we're ready to blast off, remember, we had just lost Columbia Space Shuttle. We lost a crew of seven. But there was no concern on my part because I had worked at NASA as an engineer. I had worked in the trenches and saw the dedication of the people that work at NASA, because NASA is a government agency, and an engineer, a scientist, a researcher can make more money on the private sector than in NASA. And so all these people that are there are not there for the money. They're there because they have the passion of space exploration. So when we go on a mission, there's thousands of people we depend on. And at one point, I was one of them when I was the branch chief of the materials and processes branch. And I know that all these people have done their best to ensure we were going to have a safe flight and a safe return back home. So there was no concern on my part with respect to saying, oh, wow, this is going to be real dangerous and I'm freaking out. But rather, I said, hey, you know, we're prepared. Let's get going and let's go to space.
And Jose, now you're an astronaut ready to head to outer space. You're ready to take off and you hear the launch countdown and the mission got aborted due to bad weather. And then there was another delay. I think there was something about a loose valve. It could have been that the weather saved your life. I thought that when I was reading that. So Jose, you have lots of angels around you. And besides Adela, your wife, and your mom, you got many angels, I'll tell you. And so in the third time, the Space Shuttle Discovery finally head off outdoors. So please tell us about this moment, the final countdown. And how was the feeling of reaching this incredible speed? I'm talking about breaking the sound barrier and crossing the atmosphere to finally float above the Earth. At that moment, do you remember what was going on into your mind?
Well, you know, you're right that we got scrubbed. The mission got scrubbed twice. The first time we were actually on the shuttle, fully fueled and loaded. And then it started raining and lightning, and so it got canceled. That was a Monday. On Wednesday, we were getting ready to go to the ship, and that's when they found that faulty fuel valve. So you're right, the weather may have saved our lives because they replaced that fuel valve. And then Friday, what third time was the charm, was when we launched. And you're sitting there, and the three engines light up, so you hear this gentle roar. and you feel it, a gentle vibration, you close your visor and you turn on your oxygen so that you're in a closed environment. And then a second later, the two solid rocket boosters turn on. The noise level goes up order of magnitude. The vibration looks like it feels like it's a 9.5 earthquake. And just when you think it's going to fall over, you feel a push in your back, and that's liftoff. And you go from 0 to 17,500 miles an hour in 8.5 minutes. I mean, it's the best ride Disneyland can ever hope for.
Oh, my God.
You pull 3 Gs in the process. In other words, it feels as if 3 people are standing on your chest, so it's even hard to breathe as you're going up. But once you're up there, you reach main engine cutoff, MECO, and at 17,500 miles an hour, and all of a sudden, that big 500-pound gorilla disappears, and now you're loosey-goosey in your seat with your seatbelt, and now you're going around the world once every 90 minutes at 17,500 miles an hour, which is about 28,000 kilometers an hour. And so you're doing that, and I remember the first time I unbuckled my seatbelt, because you have to change from the orange pumpkin suit, it's called the launch entry suit, LES, to street clothes. And you go down to the mid deck. We're in the flight deck. And I remember I did my best Superman impersonation to come down to the mid deck. But then in the hatch, there's a window where we're looking down on Earth. And we had just made one revolution when it was my turn to unbuckle. And I could see Canada, United States, and Mexico. And I'll tell you what struck me as beautiful, Cecilia, was that I couldn't tell where one country ended and the other began. And I said, my gosh, I had to go out of this world to realize that down there, we're just one. We're one race. We're the human race.
That was exactly what I was going to ask you, because we talk about embracing your identity,
but then watching the earth from above and how this changed your perspective, that it suddenly came from a whole new level. I thought how we humans construct our identity in terms of nationality, religion, race, and so on.
It's a very humbling, it's a aha moment, because, you know, you see it and you say, why is there so much conflict in the world? We're just one down there. We're one race. We're the human race. I mean, borders are human-made concepts designed to separate us. And how sad, because from my perspective, we're just one. And I've always, I've said in my interviews, I said, I hope one day we get to the point that we can, it becomes a prerequisite that every world leader that gets elected, comes to power, takes this journey into space so that they can see the great world of ours. And I'll guarantee you that there would be less conflict in this world of ours, because they would get that same humbling feeling that I got.
And being up there, you raised a wonderful prayer, which if you allow me, I would like to read to our audience. Let us, Lord, see your love in the world. Forgive us for our wrongdoings. Give us the faith to trust in your goodness. Forgive our ignorance and weakness. Give us the power to continue trusting wholeheartedly, and show us what we can do for peace on earth. Amen. And then, sir, returning home, the space shuttle also got delayed. For me, when I was reading the book, it was wonderful to see that the landing took place in a different spot. A very special spot, right?
Usually our preferred landing site is in Florida, where we launch from. But because the weather was bad and flight rules dictate that if you can't land within 24 hours, you go to your second preferred site, which was I was happy with, because it's my home state, California. And it was in Southern California, Edwards Air Force Base. Only problem is my wife, parents, and kids were waiting for me in Florida, but we landed in California, so I met up with them back in Houston when I returned. But yes, I remember coming and landing. I call it a poetic justice landing, because where I landed, is about some 70 miles from where I used to pick strawberries as a kid. And here I was coming in with the American flag, the NASA logo as an astronaut from outer space, landing as the flight engineer, third in line to pilot the shuttle. We're landing the space shuttle at Edwards Air Force Base. So truly, truly very humbling for me.
I don't think this was a coincidence. And if it is, I'll call it divine fortune.
Yes.
And choosing your children and wife over NASA was something that also struck me as worth of mentioning today. When you got back from space, you were going to retire because the spatial program had all remaining flights already assigned, so you were not getting any other mission. But based on your background and the fact that you could speak Russian, and of course your know-how of the U.S. program to denuclearize the former Soviet Union and so on, there was a possibility that you could get assigned to a mission with the Russians. Could you tell us about you saying no to NASA and your decision to say, okay, that's it for me?
Sure. Well, you know, you're right. As soon as I came back, they announced the retirement of the shuttle fleet. There was going to be four more flights after our flight, and they were already assigned. So I knew I wasn't going to get another shuttle flight. But I was one of the first in lines to get assigned to a mission with the Russians, because once the space shuttle retires, there's not going to be another U.S. vehicle for 10 to 12 years. That's how long it takes to develop a new vehicle. If you look at the Apollo, the last Apollo mission occurred in 72. The first shuttle mission didn't occur until 81, 9 years later. Well, here, Artemis is barely going off the ground, and we're already over 11 years since we retired the space shuttle. So I was right that we weren't going to fly in the foreseeable future on a U.S. vehicle. But no need to fear. I was going to get assigned on a station flight on a Russian Soyuz rocket with the Russians. And I was excited. And of course, I was qualified because, you know, I knew Russian and all that. But then I read the fine print. I read that the training program is 3 years. 80% of it is in Russia. And it's not continuous. It's you go 6 weeks, come back a week, 8 weeks, come back 2 weeks. So it's not like you can take your family. So you're back and forth on the period of 3 years. Then you go up for 6 months, and then you come back and go on the road for 6 months. So that's a four-year period where you're not sleeping in your own bed for 85% of the time. And at that point in my life, I have five children. The oldest is 14. The youngest is 6. And I did the math. I said, this is going to be about 4 years before all this is said and done. My oldest is going to be 18, 19 already in college. And I'm going to miss dances, first dates and all that of my three daughters and then my youngest son, because I have a boy and two boys, oldest and youngest, and then three girls in the middle. And, you know, I just drew the line in the sand. I said, you know, I think this is too much to ask my wife to raise the kids on her own. I thought it would be unfair. I think especially these teenage years, these are the years kids need guidance and they need both parents. And so it was the hardest decision in my life to make. But I made the decision to basically resign from NASA and come back home to California because, I put family first, and it hurt me to have give up, you know, what I worked for so hard, but I don't regret it because I think family is first. You know, that 14-year-old, in June, he graduates with his PhD at Purdue University in aerospace engineering. My three girls have already graduated college. One of them has a master's. And my youngest is a sophomore in mechanical engineering at UC Merced. So I think I made the right decision.
And you know, this is exactly what I thought. Going into space was a dream for you and not an obsession. And that is what I thought when I read what you wrote. You wrote, there is more than one star and one goal in life. And this, Jose, you made it reality. We have seen in various stages of your life how you did not let your dream consume you, but rather inspire you and propel you. And I believe that is exactly where you can tell the difference between an obsession and a dream, which is more like a driving force. And now you have a foundation, right? And this is called Tierra Luna Engineering. Well, we have a small clip, and we will hear now Dr. Andrew Seely, president of the Migration Policy Institute's take on education and immigration.
It's how you look at all parts of the equation, right? I mean, you want to make sure that immigrants feel included and are in fact included and have the same access to education and public services and rights. And at the same time, also make sure that those that were there before also still feel included and feel that they're not being left behind. I mean, that, and often, you know, we talk about this, there's often an effort to do programs for immigrants. And sometimes that is important, especially during a time of transition. I mean, you need to think about language and you need to think, and it's certainly very important with refugees, right? And people's, you know, ability to integrate into the new society they've arrived in. But over time, what you really want is to invest not in immigrant education, but invest in education in places that have large immigrant communities, right? And you invest in education everywhere, but you want to make sure that you're investing not just in the immigrant side of the equation, but in the whole community, right? And how people that were already there and people who've arrived more recently see it as a common enterprise to, you know, to make their community succeed, to make their school succeed, to make their economic future together succeed.
So I think you nailed this one with your Reaching for the Stars Foundation, which is devoted to support and promote education among students and the community. So could you tell us about your foundation?
The foundation is called the Jose Hernandez Reaching for the Stars Foundation. And its website is astrojh.org. You'll see what we do there. Very proud of this foundation because we preach the good gospel of STEM education. We reach out to kids in the fifth grade. No accident there because fifth graders are 10 years old. And we expose them to careers in STEM, in science, technology, engineering, and math. And since I decided I want to be an astronaut when I was 10 years old, I figured that's when we should start reaching out to the kids. And so we have this big one-day science fair where the kids come and we expose them to these careers. We also have a summer academy for kids from seventh grade all the way through the end of high school, 12th grade. And they come 6 weeks to a university because we want to see them, that they see themselves in a university setting, expose them to university facilities, give them classes, prepare them for next year's math and science courses, but we make it very entertaining, very hands-on, but they learn all the concepts so that when they go back to school in the fall, they're very well prepared. From 7th to 12th grade, we do that. And then funding allowing, we give scholarships to the kids that are graduating so that they can go off and they can see that we're investing in them, that we believe in them. Sometimes it just takes someone believing in them to make sure that they believe in themselves. And so that's what we do. We're very proud of that. That's the Reaching for the Stars Foundation. TierraLunaEngineering.com. That's my consulting business in aerospace, renewable energy. And that's where you can actually buy my book, the one that you have. I have three books there. You can get it cheaper at Amazon, quite frankly. But if you buy it through TierraLunaEngineering.com, I actually autograph it and will dedicate it however you want me to dedicate it and then send it to you. The proceeds of those books go to the foundation. And so you're helping a good cause if you buy it through TierraLunaEngineering.com. And so that's what we do with respect to what we're doing now.
And so to close, I have my last question, which is about our perception of time. If there's someone that out of his own lifetime experience can talk about the relativity of time, it would be someone like you. Through your observation of nature, when moving with the harvesting seasons as a kid and working those long summers and then out of there in space, rotating 91 times a day, also being time so crucial in space for NASA as well as the astronauts. And at the end, walking along your vineyards with your dad, probably talking about the day, agriculture, and life. All of this has probably provided you with an incredible perspective on motion and the passing of time. So my last question is, after all of this, what is your take on time?
Well, my take on time is, number one, you can't cheat time. Time is time. Time's going to come and go, and you're going to come and go with it. So there's no sense wasting energy in trying to delay time, delay the inevitable. Because we all have a certain amount of time here on this precious earth of ours. And this is where I always tell folks that it's great to set goals for yourself. But if you're not enjoying the journey towards achieving that goal, my argument is you probably picked the wrong goal. Because it's about 90% of your time and effort is the journey to reaching that goal. So I always tell people, be careful what you pick and then evaluate if you're enjoying that journey. Because if you're not enjoying it, chances are you're wasting your time. And time is so precious, we can never get it back to ourselves. We're all growing older day by day, and we got to do what we love. I came full circle in my life. You know, there's a saying, you can take the kid out of the farm, but you can't take the farm out of the kid. And so I came full circle, and when I had the chance to buy a vineyard and go work, you know, to me, it's, you know, it's the astronaut farmer. You know, I came full circle and I enjoy so much working with my father. 85 years old, he still gets on the tractor and he helps me in my vineyard. I mean, these are the most precious times I'm spending with my father, high quality time that I'm not going to have I still been an astronaut, God forbid something happens to them. I would be regretting and say, coulda, woulda, shoulda. Well, there's no coulda, woulda, shoulda because I'm doing it right now. I'm spending that precious time. And I'm very thankful that I have this opportunity to do it.
Jose, Mr. Hernandez, sir, you have moved us today in so many levels. Your determination of following your dreams with strength and resilience, your experience in outer space, as well as the difficulties and wonders of migrating, and your humbleness and sense of gratitude have moved us, most of us, to tears. Before we end, I want to tell you that, beyond all of these incredible accomplishments, it is your sense of community, your inspiring character of perseverance and endurance, your belief in family values, and your striving for excellence what really makes you stand out. I want to thank you for sharing your life and family stories with us, and for inspiring kids of all ages to dream the impossible. Thank you, sir, for sharing this incredible journey with us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I love giving conferences, motivational conferences. So hopefully I'll have the opportunity to go to Germany one day, to Europe, because I travel a lot in California, in the U.S., all over the U.S., and Mexico, and South America. I've yet to go over the pond and go to Europe and Spain and Germany and France. I'd love to go down there. So we'll wait for your guys' invitation and we'll go over there.
Thank you, sir, for sharing this incredible journey with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you to all our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. We hope this interview has not only expanded your perspective, but have moved you to dream about space and your personal stars. Please be sure to check this episode description shall you wish to donate to the Reaching for the Stars Foundations or buy the book we have been talking about, or perhaps some wine. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.
You see less than 50?
Happy, Jose.
Oh, yeah.
All right. 103, 103, Team Ecos.